Well, if you're in your 30s or 40s or 50s or older, your parents and teachers probably warned you about stranger danger. We weren't supposed to talk to people we didn't know, supposed to run away if someone tried to get us in our car. Today, it's not as clear. I mean, those are certainly, that's clearly stranger danger, but it's not so clear who the strangers are these days, especially with social media. Parents who don't grow up with computers, let alone Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr, are going to feel ill-equipped to help their kids stay safe. We're going to talk about that today with Megan Marino. She is a member of the Division of Adolescent Medicine at Seattle Children's Hospital. She's an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington, does her research through the Center for Child Health, Behavior, and Development, and is the principal investigator of the Social Media and Adolescent Health Research Team, and SMART, it's called. Megan's goal is to develop innovative approaches to promote adolescent health. Joins us today, and let me get her on the, I suppose I should put her online here. Megan, thanks so much for spending time with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're used to the phrase sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's something we've all heard. But here you've got your book. It's called Sex, Drugs, and Facebook.
It is. It is. And I think it highlights how some of these things that were worrisome, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, have evolved over time.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I'm really enjoying the book. It's, I have a 10-year-old daughter. And so, you know, and she's, she doesn't have a Facebook or a Twitter account, but she's online a lot, plays a lot of games, and does research for her class assignments and stuff. So it's something that's really on my mind, and I'm sure it's on the mind of so many of our listeners, probably anybody who's listening. And you've done a lot of research into this whole area of kids and social media.
We have. I was fortunate enough to start my work with adolescent health around the time that MySpace and Facebook were becoming really popular. So just as I was learning to work with adolescent patients, one of the main things that they were talking to me about is what they thought about MySpace and Facebook and health behaviors they saw on those sites, and what did they think about them? How could I advise them about them? And so that was really when our research started, was from those questions that patients were asking.
And your research, actually, it has some Wisconsin connection.
Yes. I was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison up until December of 2012. So I was really fortunate to be there during that time and be really supported by the university in wanting to look into connections between health and social media. And I really benefited from a rich network of colleagues across campus in the School of Education and different places where there were other people who really had that expertise in the media side of things.
Well, we've really moved from being a sort of passive consumers of information on the web to really content producers on social media, and that means a lot, especially for our kids, does it not?
It does, and I think you hit the nail on the head with it. I think so many generations of traditional media, we talked about messages being created by corporations and then sort of injected into our youth. It was really one-directional, and now youth are their creators and consumers, as you said. And so I think one way that impacts youth is that the messages that they view are more likely to be powerful because now you're combining the influence of media along with another big influence for teens, which is peer pressure.
Yeah, and boy, there's a lot that can go wrong.
There is. There's a lot that can go right and a lot that can go wrong.
Well, you talk about young children. You talk about tweens and teenagers and college-age kids. Maybe let's take teens in high school. Still living at home, what are some of the dynamics at play there?
Sure. I think that what we would consider middle adolescence is the time in high school. We consider early adolescence sort of that 10 to 14-ish time period, and then later adolescence is that 18 to 23 time period. But it is that middle adolescence period where most teens are in high school, most teens are living at home with parents or guardians, and developmentally, that time of adolescence is usually the time where teens are most pushing for independence and most wanting to really distinguish themselves as individuals separate from their family. But it's also a time period where they haven't fully developed their identities, and so most often their identity becomes whatever peer group they're in.
Yeah. So what function do social media play for teenagers?
I think that some social media sites, I think if you take Facebook as a popular example, it really is almost perfectly designed for adolescents that age because they're seeking an identity and Facebook allows them to create this profile and populate it with whatever they want and populate it with whatever markers of whatever identity they're trying. Another big piece of this age of adolescence is wanting to connect to peers. And Facebook lets you do that both with tools as well as to link your profile within a network. So it really allows adolescents to visually understand where they are within a particular social network.
Yeah.
So in some adolescents that I've talked to in clinic will say that Facebook gives them a sense of independence. So for example, if you're an adolescent and you live at home and you have four brothers and sisters or extended generations living at home and it's hard to get a sense of privacy, they'll take their iPad in a corner and suddenly they feel really independent being immersed in that online world.
Yeah. And of course, parents are worried about this. And, you know, you want them to be independent, but they also have to kind of develop this ability. And here we are, we're trying to balance our need and responsibility to keep them safe with allowing that independence. It's a difficult task for parents.
It is. And I think for so long we haven't been sure how to frame the guidance we give people. In the American Academy of Pediatrics, we are supposed to tell patients that teens should not be online or on any screen time more than 2 hours a day. Well, that's a really tough recommendation these days. It doesn't really get at what your teen is doing online. It doesn't get at, it's pretty hard to monitor if your kid has a cell phone that they bring into their room. And so I think what we wanted was something that was, it was a little more grounded, and not so rigid as the 2 hours, but a little more grounded in some of the safety messages that we know parents really know and understand well.
Yeah. I should have started with this, but maybe we can back up to it a bit. Tell us about the book. I'm really enjoying reading it, Sex, Drugs, and Facebook, A Parent's Toolkit for Promoting Healthy Internet Use.
Sure. We wanted to design the book to have some similarity with what we heard from parents. They really appreciated about parent guidebooks for younger kids. So many parent guidebooks for younger kids will start out with a couple chapters that frame the ages, the stages, the approach that the book is going to take, and then have specific chapters that address certain health needs. So I still remember with my kids, I got the AAP, the Birth to Five book, and the beginning of it was about kids who are birth to five, and then there were separate chapters on things like tantrums and sleep difficulties. So we really modeled our book after that, with the first three chapters really get into what is happening on the web, what are the adolescent developmental considerations in how they interact with the web, and then presenting a model to think about in how to approach internet safety. And the model is looking at balance, boundaries, and communication.
And I like the fact that you have, you've really involved a lot of people. So you've got direct quotes from parents, from kids at all levels.
Yes, we did. We really wanted this to be something that represented more than just what me as one single adolescent health medicine person thinks. I think we wanted it to have some applicability across different ages and different populations. And I think one thing I've learned from doing work that relates to health and media is that there's a lot of people out there with expertise in it. And the best way you can create the best product is by working with those people.
Yeah. We're talking today with Megan Marino about her book, Sex, Drugs, and Facebook, and certainly we'll inviting your questions and comments as we move along today at 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you worry, or maybe you don't understand very much about social media in order to provide guidance. And is that a truism? I mean, are there a lot of parents out there who really don't know that much about the area?
I think that there's more parents now that either because of their work or their own interests are becoming more and more internet savvy. But I think what we often see in clinic is that parents don't realize how much they know about safety, and that they really can take what they know about safety and with a few word changes really translate it into knowing about internet safety.
I really like that you suggest that parents ask their older children to explain social media to them. That's kind of a cool way to do things. What are some good ways to do that?
I think parents sometimes are reluctant to let their teens know if they don't know as much about social media. And parents can sit down with teens and just be upfront about, I'm not entirely sure how this website works, or tell me what makes this website so interesting to you. Why is Facebook so cool? What's different about Twitter compared to Facebook? And what we found is teens can talk all day about that, and they really like being able to have their expertise understood by other people. So I think letting your teen be in that role of an expert social media consultant, that can really open the door to then when it's the parent's turn to say, okay, now I want to tell you some things that I noticed about your privacy settings. Can you help me understand how we can make this safer? Then teens are a lot more likely to listen to their parents when their expertise has been recognized.
And you see different people with that age range having different ideas about whether or not to be involved, to be friends with their kids or their friends, their kids' friends, whether or not to do that. Some do and some don't.
Yes, we certainly see a lot of different patterns. We see in some families it is a requirement for younger teens and sometimes for older teens to be Facebook friends with their parents in order to have a profile. And we also see in some families that that's not a requirement, but sometimes teens are reaching out and being Facebook friends with friends of their parents. So sometimes, there's one cool aunt who's friends with all the nieces and nephews and knows everything that's going on. And we love those cool aunts.
We are talking today with Megan Marino, who is an author, the book Sex, Drugs, and Facebook, and she'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. We are living in the age of technology and online interaction. We've moved on from the internet being a way for people to sort of passively get information to Web 2.0 when we're creating and sharing our own content, and that's especially true for our young people. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Really happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're getting some good advice on keeping our youngsters safe while they explore the world and express themselves through social media with Megan Marino, who is a member of the Division of Adolescent Medicine at Seattle's Children's Hospital. She's an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington, does her research through the Center for Child Health Behavior and Development, and is the principal investigator of the social media and adolescent health research team. Her goal is to develop innovative approaches to promote adolescent health, and we can read all about it in the book Sex, Drugs, and Facebook, A Parent's Toolkit for Promoting Healthy Internet Use. That's her book, and great to have her with us today. Megan, thanks so much for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. You may have some questions for her. Do you worry that you don't understand social media enough to guide your child or help your grandchild? Do you wonder about the appropriate boundaries to set for a child, the particular ages of the children you have? Is your child using social media? Do you think you've had the necessary discussions with them? Do you have some experiences to share, good or bad, about your relationship with your child? and using social media. We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page. Just go to the Larry Mueller Show. You can post an experience, a question, or a comment there. Would love to hear from you. Megan, you told me that you, you've done a lot of research, and you mentioned that you've talked to, interviewed many young people, and I expect probably there were things that kind of surprised you, or did anything surprise you as you visited with young people about their social media?
Wow, that's a great question. I can't think of a time that I wasn't surprised in some way. I feel like one thing that makes the social media world so interesting is that it's always changing. Different platforms come up and become popular. I think Twitter probably started around 05 or 06, and I remember initially hearing about it from some patients who said, oh, this is so irritating. I would never use this. And I remember thinking, okay, well, we won't really do any projects on this because it's not likely to last. And here it is, 2013, and it's one of the more popular ones. So I think we were always humbled by the surprises that we learn and how things change. And even once we feel like we have a good grasp of how a particular platform works, like Facebook, then at least every year Facebook changes something. I think probably recently you've seen they changed their privacy settings so that younger teens can now select to make their content publicly available. And that's the first time Facebook's allowed that. So I think we were always prepared for surprises and always prepared that things are changing.
Yeah, and there's always a lot of change out there. Some of it I think, oh, that's good, and some of it I just hate, to be perfectly honest.
Yes, but I guess we're all getting so used to the changes that if you don't like it, you just wait it out, and yep. In another year it'll be different.
Scott in New Richmond, thanks for calling. Hi.
How's it going?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Good. I'm currently studying to be an early childhood educator at UWRF. Mm-hmm. I'm also a father of a 2-year-old daughter. I have a 6-month-old son, three-month-old son as well. My question is, I'm concerned that as social media becomes this staple for everyday life and even kind of infiltrating education, what is the best, I mean, is it even practical for me to hope to limit my daughter's, you know, access as a child to social media and to websites and things like that to keep her safe? Or is this something I should just, not only as a teacher but as a father, just embrace?
I think that's a really great question, and I think it's something that we in pediatrics think about as well as you folks in education. I think that when you think about teenagers and social media, there's a lot of interesting concepts to grab onto, like communication and peer relations and tasks that are really developmentally appropriate for teenagers. And then we can think about what are ways that social media might have benefits as well as risks. When we look at early childhood, the developmental tasks are very different. The kids are learning how to, how to eat lunch at a table with 4 other kids and how to explore the world around them with their senses and their hands. And those are developmental time periods in which media probably doesn't have a lot to add, if you think about it. Mm-hmm. So I think that many people, at least probably in your field as well as mine, are really questioning what the added value of media or a lot of media would be in that time frame. So I think it is reasonable for us to not accept the intrusion of media into that early childhood period as a foregone conclusion.
Can I just add a quick thought to that comment?
Sure.
My other piece to that is that, you know, I see a lot of times where children are, you know, kind of as they get into the 9, 10, 11-year-old range, they start, you know, parents are buying them cell phones and you know, these smartphones are increasingly capable of, you know, so many different things. And in my 2-year-old year, 3-year-old year, I would never have been, you know, able to use a tab, and my daughter is using, you know, I'm worried that, like, these types of things are not going to get better. It's only going to get worse. So do you have any follow-up to you know, how to properly, approach that as, and what age frame I should be looking at as a father?
It's a great question. I think that some of our research has suggested that somewhere around ages 8, 9, 10 might be good times to start to introduce basics of technology. And perhaps a benefit could be that if you start earlier, then maybe some of those safety messages will become part of the norm for those younger kids. And then as they get to be 11, 12, 13, and they're doing more on the web independently, hopefully those safety messages and skills will have had time to sink in. I haven't seen any literature that supports, you know, five-year-olds, six-year-olds really actively engaging in media. I think many of us, our kids are getting exposed to it from, you know, playing around with our phones.
Yeah.
And I think in a limited way, that's probably not doing a lot of harm. But I think we shouldn't oversell ourselves that it's doing a lot of good for them at that age. What I often see in our pediatric clinics actually is more concerns about how parents behave when they're interacting with social media and not giving the attention to two-year-olds that they need. We see a lot of safety risks, you know, parents checking their cell phone while their child is climbing up a bookcase. So I think we also need to look at ourselves as parents and make sure that we're giving attention to the people in front of us instead of the people that we're Facebook friends with.
Yeah, good points. Thanks, Scott, for calling. Bob in Oshkosh, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, I just wanted to talk. I work at a mental health institute with adolescents, and we see a lot of people posting things to Facebook in regards to suicide. I just wanted to ask your guest here how often she sees that.
That's great. I'm so glad you bring that up. That's an area of research we've been working on because of similar concerns that we've seen in clinic. And one area we've been looking on is whether you could use a tool like Facebook or Twitter to follow adolescents who have consented to be followed and then look for escalations in them discussing depression symptoms. So what we're interested in is both the suicidal ideation that's expressed on these sites, as well as whether you could identify and prevent that by following symptoms, but kind of prior to things getting quite that bad. So it's an area we're really interested in. We've heard from adolescents that it's very common to put suicidal symptoms and depression symptoms on social media as a way to seek help or seek support. And we're really hoping to understand more about that and whether there's the potential for prevention work.
And that is something that I see at work. You know, people will post something, and that is what leads to their admission to us. And a lot of times, you know, it's helpful. So I think it's important that, you know, parents are aware of what their kids are posting in regards to that. It may be some kind of early warning signs or just something that you can see that might give you a key that you're, you know, your kid's having some feelings that they might not be able to talk about.
Yeah.
And we have heard about it enough. We ended up putting an entire chapter in the book on special health concerns of depression and eating disorders. Those are two common ones that we see among our patients and hear about from some of the participants in our study. So I'm so glad to hear that your group has been able to learn about that and learn about the positive side of using those signals to identify people.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Bob, for calling. Lyric in Blanchardville, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I have a concern. I drove home late from work last night about midnight, and I heard on BBC that Facebook has just recently changed its policy where it now shows pictures of decapitation and death and murder. And I'm wondering what kinds of screens or filters that Facebook has or that parents can use or friends of parents to help prevent children or adolescents, young teens, young adults from viewing these images?
That is a fantastic question. I think that one thing that's a little tricky that we've learned is no matter how good a screen or a filter is, there's usually an adolescent on almost every block who is technology savvy enough to get around it. And I think it is unfortunate that Facebook's changed that policy. However, what some teens in our studies have told us is if they want to view certain kinds of material, they know, I mean, you can Google it, and Google will get you there faster even than Facebook. So I think the tricky thing is being able to set up expectations and talk with kids about what kinds of materials are okay to view and what kinds aren't, and why are you seeking these types of material. I think it's tricky that early adolescent age in particular is a time of curiosity, and kids will sometimes look into things that are scary or fascinating to them. And the web gives them new tools to do that behavior, but that behavior itself has been around for a millennia.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Appreciate your call. Talking with Megan Marino, who is author of Sex, Drugs, and Facebook, A Parent's Toolkit for Promoting Healthy Internet Use. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Love to hear your experiences. Lynn in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hello.
Good afternoon, Larry and Megan. I am the grandmother of a 12-year-old who had been experiencing some bullying in middle school. And then I found her doing the mean girl act, you know, giving back the cyberbullying on Facebook. And spoke with her parents, and she's been banned from social media. But the kids are really, really tech savvy, and you have to be uber. She's going to find a way. That, like you said, there's somebody who's going to give her the opportunity to vent via social media.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a tricky one. We've done some work related to cyberbullying, and one of our team members, Regita Cota, who's actually at the UW School of Medicine right now, has done some really groundbreaking work looking at cyberbullying victims and bullies and the people who fall into the category of both. And the category of folks who have been bullied and then go on to bully others it's really quite common, as you can probably imagine. It's probably a natural kind of backlash, as you describe it. I think the tricky thing is some of the other literature out there suggests that that's a group that really needs some special attention and really needs a place to be able to vent and process the bullying that happened to them, and then be able to understand the connections with how they are inflicting that same type of hurt on other people. And then often by being able to connect those two experiences, and this could be through talking with friends or counselors or family members. Boy, grandmas are sure good at that. I think sometimes that can be a way to approach those behaviors, because you're right. I think whenever we think of a solution that's technological, we have to realize that we're going up against the technological experts.
Yeah.
Now, Megan, can I follow up?
Sure. Go ahead, Lynn.
With this type of behavior in my granddaughter, I've also seen things escalate. And enough to worry about. In little behaviors, and I don't know if I'm enough for, you know, to say, you can't do this, this isn't. She doesn't have, she's the oldest of three, you know, it's just, there's so many, you know, well, you understand. And, you know, I don't want to get her any deeper into her own pain than need be.
Oh, understood. Mm-hmm. It's really tricky, and I think that's why people have suggested that people who become bullies as a result of being bullied are this group that needs some special attention. And I think thinking about a place where she could have a safe place to let out some of her experiences, whether that's with you or whether she starts that conversation with you and you help her find another place to continue those conversations or to build new skills, I think can be really helpful. But I wouldn't underestimate the power of just you being there to support her and letting her know that you're worried about her.
And I think, actually, didn't your research show that teens, that children really look to their parents and perhaps grandparents for guidance?
They do. And studies have shown even just having conversations that the parents thought were everyday conversations about how are you doing or, you know, what happened or different things, those can have a huge impact on that teen, even if the parents thought, oh, I didn't think I did anything that special. So I think even just asking questions about whether you're okay, what do you think about, what does this behavior mean? What happened to you before? I'm a safe person you can come to. And what we've learned in clinic is sometimes teens won't talk the first time you ask, but sometimes if you keep asking, you let them know that you're there for those types of conversations, sometimes they'll warm up to it.
Yeah, good points. Lynn, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call, and good luck with your granddaughter. I hope things work out for you in the long run. You come up with, you have three elements that make up what you refer to as the healthy internet use model in your book. And I'm wondering if we can go through those.
Sure. We developed those three concepts in a way that was really special to us. Some of it came out of our research we had done. Some of it came out of clinical experience by me, as well as other adolescent medicine docs and nurses. And then we really put those experiences together in discussions with the American Academy of Pediatrics, who really is one of the national child health experts in the world as an organization. And what we distilled down to these key concepts of balance, boundaries, and communication. And to us, balance really means that balance between online and offline life. And I think that for every family, that might be a little bit different. I think you could start with thinking about the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendation of 2 hours. But, you know, for some kids, 2 hours is too much. And so thinking about within your family, what is that balance of online and offline so that your child is still getting time to have face-to-face communication, be involved in activities or in their community? That balance concept to us was something that seemed to be really helpful in thinking about a healthy amount of internet use.
And boundaries.
I think boundaries gets at both being able to put limits around how much information you share online, as well as where you're looking for information online, who you're interacting with, what sort of boundaries and safety nets do you want to put around yourself, both to protect yourself from privacy invasions, as well as to protect yourself from inappropriate information, inappropriate people, the different dangers that are out there. And so to us, boundaries means setting those limits on both how much you put out there as well as how much you take in.
Yeah. And communication.
I think communication gets at the idea that this isn't going to be a simple set of rules that parents give their kids when they're 12 and assume that they're done. It's really an ongoing process and ongoing communications between teens and parents. It's a little different than some of the other basic health things that parents teach about nutrition or going to bed and getting a good night's sleep. This is really an area where the different websites are always evolving, different privacy settings change, and a new discussion needs to be had about what the family's views and rules are going to be about that website. So I think to us, communication really emphasized the idea that things are going to be changing and the teen's going to be growing and getting new experiences. And so this needs to be an ongoing conversation.
Yeah, and you say that conversation, in some sense, as you mentioned earlier, it really isn't about social media, but applying some kind of age-old lessons for staying safe to this new technology.
It is. I mean, if you think about the things we grew up with, don't talk to strangers. Well, that applies pretty darn well these days. And, you know, come home straight after school. Don't go into any dark alleys. Well, I think that applies to, you know, get your homework done online and don't go wandering into decapitated head websites.
What's your reaction to the book so far? What's been the reaction to your book?
That people have really liked the positive tone of thinking about ways to prevent and intervene, but also thinking about the benefits of the web and keeping those in balance. This isn't meant to be a book that's supposed to scare people straight. It's meant to be a book about providing skills and tools from the vantage point of a variety of experiences. And we've liked that people seem to get that that's what we're trying to do.
And I really like the fact that you include so many quotes from researchers and parents and teachers and children in all ages.
Yeah, we did want to really emphasize the collaborative nature of the book. Every chapter had between one and three co-writers on it, and the entire book was reviewed by a parent of three adolescents who I figure is probably has more expertise than all of us put together.
Well, this has been a wonderful conversation, Megan. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. It's I learned a bunch, and You know, as I said, I have a 10-year-old at home, and I'm hanging on to your book.
The time is coming.
Thanks, Megan.
Thank you so much.
Megan Marino is the author of Sex, Drugs, and Facebook, A Parent's Toolkit for Promoting Healthy Internet Use. You might want to take a look at it. Tomorrow, David Drake and Jamie Knack come by to talk about our Wisconsin wildlife, hear about whooping crane migration, various seasons, and what wildlife is doing to prepare for winter. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.